Yeah.
All right, y'all ready to start? I'm Pete Wellborn. I'm a technology lawyer here in Atlanta. Represent Earthlink, do a lot of internet-related work, IP work. Don't hold the fact that I'm a lawyer against me because I don't like them any more than you do. And that's probably bad to say since I'm being recorded. But anyway, the topic here is Napster. Y'all tell me why y'all are here. I like to talk about what y'all want to hear, not necessarily what I want to talk about. I also like to keep things, this is a fairly small group, so I'd much rather have a conversation with y'all about this than just lecture. There's nothing, well, only thing worse than me talking for an hour would be having to listen to me talk for an hour. So, you know, don't raise your hand. We're not in a class, although you don't have to raise your hand in my class. I teach internet law over at Tech. I have one of my esteemed former students here. Okay, well, I'll repeat the question, too. So just if you have a comment, you know, just blurt it out or a question, I'll repeat it, and then we'll talk about it. But anyway, why are y'all here? What interests y'all about this topic? What'd you expect to hear? Anybody? Not all at once. Right here in front.
I used Napster in the past to get music from various artists. Now I have to use another means, Nutella, to get a lot of the same recordings. Will Napster ever go back to being what it once was?
Okay, well, we'll cover that. I can also give you some others that might even be a little easier to use than Nutella. Ten different ones. But that's only for academic purposes only, because I would never, of course, encourage the theft of protected intellectual property over the Internet. Anybody else? Why you're here, what you think about it. Trying to get an idea if y'all are pro-Napster, if y'all grudgingly admit that it's illegal, if y'all, you know, exactly what you feel about it. Anybody carry a tune here? Up? No. Somebody here can carry a tune. Scott, how about you? Remember the old song, Seasons in the Sun? We had joy, we had fun. I'm not even going to try it, but in case you didn't have the next hour and wanted to stay for 2 minutes, goodbye, Napster, trusted friend. We've stolen songs I thought you'd never end, but we pissed off Dr. Dre, and Judge Patel has had her say. Soon you'll go the .com way, which answers your question. We had joy, we had glee, getting gigs of songs for free, but Nutella and the rest mean no one will pay your fee. So we're done. Any questions? Now, the Napster case. I'll throw some thoughts out. Y'all tell me if you agree, disagree. The Napster case is a low point in intellectual property fascism. It's an instance of big business turns into big brother. It's an instance of proving that free enterprise is dead, that individuals no longer have rights to sit in their house at their own computer and do what they want to do. Remember that old book, you know, Things I Learned in Kindergarten, whatever the title was, something big business didn't learn in kindergarten, sharing. Further proof that money makes the world go round. Okay. I mean, does that pretty much sum up the Napster case, do y'all think? Anybody? Yes? No? And I am, of course, talking about the Napster case where Napster sued NapsterStore.com and Sports Service for selling unauthorized Napster shirts. Which y'all all heard about that case? Yeah. Yes, no? Yeah. Several months back, Sports Service was selling T-shirts with all kinds of Napster slogans, with the Napster logo, et cetera, and Napster sued for trademark infringement. So,
but that's not copyright.
Exactly. Copyright, trademark. You know, it's still the same. I still found it incredibly ironic. You know, so much for Napster being that, you know, bastion of free enterprise and sharing and the anti-Big Brother. Yeah, question in the back.
Well, more of a comment, Pete, in the sense that, you know, things that big business still hasn't learned, and maybe the justice system also hasn't learned. There are a lot of things that are illegal, but there are more shades of gray in that. I mean, for example, speeding is illegal. However, I live in Atlanta. I speed every day. It's a survival skill on the interstate if I don't want to get rear-ended. but technically it is still illegal. I mean, things just aren't that black and white, and I think that's, and this is, in the Napster case, is really showing that up, the weakness more in the legal system rather than a technology problem.
Yeah, well, and we could, I think actually we talk about it a little bit on the first day of the internet law class I teach at Tech, when we try to cram intro to law, which is a quarter-long course itself, into 2 hours for the people who hadn't had law. And one of the most fascinating areas that we just touch on for like 5 minutes is the theory of law and jurisprudence. And the philosophical question we could talk about here is, are there any absolute rights? Is there anything that is a universal truth or an absolute right? And there's nothing. I mean, everything is a shade of gray in a way. But as to address your question specifically, you know, I'll play devil's advocate for a second. That laws can be broken down into, and violations of the law, acts of violations of the law can be broken into two categories, malum per se and malum prohibitum. Malum per se is bad because it's just bad to do it. That's like killing somebody, murder. Malum prohibitum is bad because we've arbitrarily said it's bad. Speeding. There's nothing inherently evil about driving 66 instead of 65. Depending on who you talk to, this is theft. So you would have some folks that would argue that this is not quite as much a shade of gray as others would like you to think, that intellectual property theft is actually bad because it's bad and not bad just because it's said it's bad.
Pete, I'll give you a personal for instance. I had a bunch of rare and imported CDs that were in my car that were stolen. Now, I had ripped some of those to MP3 myself, and before Napster died, I actually managed to download some of the tracks because the albums themselves are just no longer available. Now, I know technically that's breaking the law because that, I'm infringing on a copyright by doing that, but I don't view that as morally reprehensible. That's why I said that the zealots in both cases really bother me. The zealots, the information wants to be free, anarchy, go find another way of making a living, and the fascists on the other side who basically, we want to charge you for breathing air.
But it's a slippery slope argument. I think even Rhea would, if they could wave a magic wand and cause the only people to download protected songs from Napster to be those who owned the tape or owned the CD or otherwise had a license to use it, who had that stolen from them, and who were simply replacing something that was stolen, no one argues against that. But the problem is it's impossible to enforce that. When you have 50 million users, all 50 million of them are not people from whom the CD was stolen.
I'll respectfully disagree. I mean, the RIA went after, I think, was it mp3.com originally, who had a system where you could insert the CD into your drive, and it would pull the index and pull the hash to prove that it was the actual genuine article, compare it with their database, and would then let you download the MP3 tracks, the versions of the tracks that were on that CD. They shut them down.
But there were also some encryption problems and then some file trading problems once you downloaded it.
Okay, I mean, that's agreed is an issue. But, I mean, the point is that they weren't even prepared to negotiate or, solve some of those technical challenges. It was just a case of, no, we don't want this. We have the power, so we'll shut it down.
Well, I mean, I'll agree with you that how Rhea handled it is stupid, maybe for a little bit different reasons, but we'll talk about it in just a second. The other Napster case we'll talk about now, the real one, not the Napster being the bad guy. I've cut out from my presentation the background on how Napster works because I assume this is about as technologically savvy an audience as I'll talk to. This is not a bunch of lawyers who can read their email, and that's kind of sort of it. What I am going to talk about is the law. Exactly what Napster was found to have done wrong in the suit. They were not found to have committed primary copyright infringement. They were not found to have infringed themselves. And there's some subtle points that might help understand from a legal point of view at least the decision. Then we'll talk about what's happened since then and as a practical matter why the whole way it was handled was a bad idea and the many companies that have stepped in to fill the void that Napster has left and is going to continue to leave. The recording industry, RIA, all the big shots, all the big wheels in the recording industry sued Napster for contributory and vicarious copyright infringement. Contributory means you help somebody else. Vicarious means you do it through somebody else. So what they were saying is that Napster, you are helping your users to commit copyright infringement.
Doesn't the library system of the United States also help every user do that as well by lending out CDs, by lending out videos? Doesn't the library system, the United States library system, also do the same thing by allowing you to borrow CDs from them too?
Well, that's a...
Or Blockbuster.
Yeah, well, that's a fair use. That falls within fair use. And what's more, I'm sure... I mean, Blockbuster has to purchase.
Yeah, but so does the library. What about a library? Is a library fair use as well? That then also falls under the slippery slope of copyright law.
Well, I mean, there are specific exceptions in the copyright laws for libraries and the Digital Millennium Copyright Act as well.
Unless it's digital copyright. The DCMA doesn't allow libraries in specific to have any specific rights better than any general user.
Well, but ostensibly, a library is an academic use. I mean,
who's to define what a library is? A library could just be a collection that I have that I give out to my friends, and then I define that as a library. I can say it's for academic use. It's for academic learning within my friend. That's how America started its library system. You know, it's very difficult for you to say, oh, a library is just for academic uses, but if you go back to your history, you find that your great founding leaders, as you call them, often did exactly the things that you Americans are being prosecuted against.
Question here, and then I'll respond to those two. No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to comment that I thought that there was a legal recourse in terms of you legally had to, if you're going to set up a library, you have to go through some legal process. I was told that by some librarians, that they had to fill out a couple of forms through their local city government to actually be called a library.
Well, yeah, which is the point. A library is a governmental entity. I mean, it's for the public good. It's going to be academic per se. I could not buy a bunch of video cassettes, you know, VCRs, whatever, call myself a video library, and start, you know, licensing, quote unquote, or renting them out, or you know, selling them for profit like that. Go ahead.
I bring it in as a person who's lived external to the world, as you can tell from my accent. The rest of the world basically doesn't force the way that the American society forces on the libraries. The library is simply a collection of people who want to distribute or loan information out to other people. And all you need to do to become a library in the United States is go to your local county, fill out one form, and basically say that you become a library for the greater good.
It's also not, libraries are also non-profit.
I've never made a profit lending out my stuff.
Well, and technically, Napster's never made a profit either, as have none of the dot-coms, but that's a different talk for a different time. Anyway, jumping back into the chronology before we get into things a little deeper here. Back in July, over a year ago, the court granted a preliminary injunction, found that Napster users were engaged in wholesale direct infringement, and issued just a blanket prohibition, said Napster cannot engage in, help others, et cetera, et cetera. That it was an absolute prohibition against helping its users or enabling its users to commit copyright infringement. So Napster appeals to the Ninth Circuit, which is the Circuit Court of Appeals, the Federal Court of Appeals out in California. And the court entered a temporary stay, you know, which means, you know, we're going to postpone the effect of the court's injunction until we can decide. And, you know, of course, with the way our judicial system rockets forward, it took them 8 months to issue the decision. But this past February, they issued the decision. One of the important things in any appellate case is, what standard does the Court of Appeals use to look at what the federal court, or what the lower court did, what the district court did? In some types of appeals or some types of cases, they'll look at it under an abuse of discretion standard. That's usually a very high standard. It's not, would we have done the same thing? Do we agree or disagree? But was this decision so wrong that it was an abuse of discretion? Here, though, it was kind of a funny situation. the abuse of discretion that was alleged, even though that was a standard, the specific kind of abuse of discretion was application of erroneous law. The Napster said, you abused your discretion, court, because you applied the completely wrong law. And any time you claim that the wrong law was applied, it's what's called the de novo review. De novo, you know, from the start, anew. And so the Court of Appeals basically disregarded, you know, what the lower court did and said, we're going to look at this fresh. You know, we're going to decide this as if we were looking at it for the first time, whether or not that's the same as the district court said or not. The court stated the issues, you know, in fancy legal words, did the court apply the right law? The plaintiff's burden of proof, the RIA's burden of proof here to prove your entitlement to what's called an injunction, which is where the court, as opposed to giving money, tells a party you can do something or you can't do something. You got to show two things. Some courts say there are four factors. Some say there are two sets of two. But you got to show that you're probably going to win. You got to show that if the injunction is not granted, you're going to suffer irreparable harm. You got to show that this issue, your case, presents a serious issue of law. And you got to show that when you just step back and look at everything, the balance of the hardships falls in your favor. So that's what RIA had to show they were entitled to the injunction. Or the plaintiffs, and I'm saying RIA, but it was, of course, a long list. Yeah, question back there.
What's the definition of irreparable harm?
Exactly. Irreparable harm is whatever the plaintiff says it is. I mean, you can go to 200 years of cases, just like you said, and find probably 200 years worth of slightly different definitions, meaning harm of such great degree in nature that no degree of monetary damages will adequately suffice to place the plaintiff in the same position they would have been, blah, 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 blah. But that's all fancy legalese for you throw in all the facts you can that show it's really going to hurt us if you don't grant. Yeah, exactly. You throw a lot up there and hope something sticks. Shotgun approach. All right, the plaintiffs said Napster users are committing direct copyright infringement. There are two parts of the direct infringement claim. Plaintiff has to show they own those rights and that there's a violation of those rights. As far as ownership, at that time, 80% of the Napster files were copyrighted. And of those, yeah.
I have a question about that.
RIA Recording.
How did they prove that they had rights to each individual song? Because as far as the discussion that was had on the Ninth Circuit, they said that they had rights to all the songs that Napster was pushing through. But from looking at I have never downloaded through Napster. I use other tools to do it. But when I did load Napster up and looked at it, I would say probably only 95 to 96% of the songs were copyrighted by RIA. Now, that's important because they actually stated that all the songs that were going through there were copyrighted.
Well, no, they actually never said that. What according to their claim, I think their figures were in the 80 to 90%, were in the 70 to 80% area of what they own copyrights of. Another 10% or so were other copyright, you know, the garage band who had copyrighted their songs, whatever, the smaller labels who were not part of this big suit. But they never claimed, and they actually discussed this at length in the Ninth Circuit opinion. The plaintiffs never claimed that they owned all the songs that were being swapped out on Napster. But what they said is that they actually owned 70% of them, which when you talk about 50 million users and however many hundreds of thousands of songs were on there, that's a staggering number.
I don't disagree with that, but yeah, the 90% came from Napster, the ARIA files plus the other files.
Whether it's 80%, 90%, 70%, that's still a staggering, huge number when you're talking about a proportion of the aggregate number of songs that were being swapped on Napster. And we'll get to it in a second, but the plaintiffs actually specifically made a point of saying, we have no problem, make no claim, et cetera, in relation to the songs that we don't own that are on your system, the garage band songs, the small band songs, the independents, et cetera. You know, we only complain of the ones that we own, which are a huge portion of the whole, but less than the whole. Well, in some cases, they actually, because we could have another panel on how labels rape the artists, but well, no, but I mean the label actually, you know, like Rhea is a plaintiff. Rhea was not the only plaintiff. Rhea is a plaintiff. Sony was a plaintiff. I mean the list of plaintiffs
was 3 pages long.
Exactly, and so the individual plaintiffs did in many cases actually own it. And in some cases, it was a collection of people who's...
I just want you to be careful about how you clarify saying Rhea owned it. It was the plaintiffs.
Oh, yeah. And I'm using Rhea collectively, misusing it as plaintiffs, and I'll try to say plaintiffs instead. Rhea was the lead plaintiff, but the plaintiffs... Rhea is a the recording industry of America, the trade group of labels. It's a big club for the labels, exactly. Good comment. Yeah, it's a trade organization of the labels, and there were other labels that were independent plaintiffs. There were also companion suits, you know, not as this decision, but y'all know that Dr. Dre and Metallica had sued in a separate lawsuit. So, you know, there are all kinds of plaintiffs flying around. But we talked about ownership. Other is violation, a violation of at least one of the exclusive rights that the Copyright Act grants. And here the court said there are two kinds of infringement. It's what's called a distribution violation and a reproduction violation. Anytime you upload a song, if you're a user putting that song out for somebody else to take, that's a distribution violation. If you download it and copy it onto your system, that's a reproduction violation. Yeah.
Let me just ask a question. Fair use does cover if, for example, I have purchased a copy of a track on one media, I'm allowed to make a copy for personal use on another media. In other words, if I own a CD, I'm allowed to tape it or rip it to MP3.
Correct.
For my own usage. It doesn't matter where I get that from to do that. So the question I was getting at is, how was that violation proved? In other words, how did they figure out how many people were actually downloading MP3s of tracks they already had legal copies of? Which would have been fair use of the system. In other words, if you own a track on CD and I cut you a tape with the same track and give it to you, that's a violation?
I was under the impression that fair use was something that allowed people to, if I have a CD and I burn a copy of it and hand it to you, and that's okay, because I own it and I'm giving it to you personally as a gift.
No, yeah, if I had a CD that you liked and I copied and gave it to you, that's absolutely a violation.
You still own the original CD, which has the rights attached to it. I have a CD that has no rights attached to it, so therefore I'm in violation.
You and I both own the same CD. You and I both have MP3 players. Okay, I'm more technically savvy than you are, so I give you the MP3 file, which you could have ripped yourself, but simply because you couldn't be bothered.
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about fair use at length here in one second.
The question was, okay, those are all shades of gray interpretations. And the original question still stands is, statistically, what proportion of the sharing was determined to be in violation, and how was that done?
If you can hold that, we'll get that in 1 second, because I talk about the fair use at length. But the quick answer to your question that we'll get to in a little detail in just a second is that with 50 million users, the sharing that was going on was between people who did not know each other, had no relationship, and therefore fell squarely outside the fair use exception. And a lot of the statistical inferences and a lot of the technology-related testimony came in from experts. And in cases you have... You know, basically, you know, excuse my language, but experts are like whores. You know, if you have a lawsuit, you can find somebody with initials after their name who will say whatever you want them to. And so cases become battle of the experts. And what's sad is that, you know, sometimes you'll have a case, and this is not this one in particular, but just in general, you'll have a case where on one side you have what's the honest to goodness truth, where you have one of the 10,000 experts you could have hired that would say the same thing. The other side finds the one crackpot who espouses crap as being true technology or true science or the truth of the expert subject. And then you have a judge who, if it's technology, maybe can't even read his own email. If it's medicine, you know, can't open the aspirin bottle, trying to decide between, you know, or help a jury decide between, you have a jury with an eighth grade education trying to decide which of these experts is telling the truth. And so it's scary sometimes that cases do become a battle of the experts like that. But in this case, I do think, you know, in a way, much that pains me to say it, but I think that Napster's experts, their arguments were much more compelling, much more cogent arguments than, Napster, the plaintiff's experts had much more compelling arguments than Napster's experts did. Yeah, although Napster had plenty of money to fund the defense, too. I mean, you know, I still can't figure out exactly what their profit model was, but... you know, how they plan to make money in the future. Well, yeah, exactly. I guess they're like the dot-coms. They're not making money off any users, but they'll go volume, 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 and figure it out later. So, question over here.
Yeah. What was the RIAA and Sony and all the big hitters in the music industry planning on doing with other forms of file exchange that have been going on for years? The bots over Dialnet, FTPs, download sites. I mean, we're talking huge amounts of data being transferred over huge amounts of people. It's been going on for years.
Well, the whole thing, that's a good question, and to me it's an issue of convenience and prevalence. I mean, if you think about it, what's going on with Napster is really no different than the example that you brought up over here. If I go over to my neighbor's house and hear a CD and like it and say, I'm going to borrow this, I take it back to my house, you know, put it in the CD player, put my cassette in my cassette player, sit there and listen to it for 2 hours, take it back. You know, I've got my bootleg cassette now, right? Well, why haven't the recording, you know, why hasn't the recording industry launched a concerted campaign against that type of copy?
But they did.
Because you can't force it
without invading privacy. Well, it's right, exactly. Number one, it's hard to enforce. And number two, that's kind of a pain in the rear. I mean, a lot of people, you know, as a practical matter, I'd rather go out and spend $11.99 than have to, you know, end up with a crappy reproduction.
It's actually not quite true. They actually have tried to break down on it in countries other than the United States. For example, Canada has a tax on CDs. Germany has a tax on cassettes and CDs. The United Kingdom and CD burners. The UK has a tax on cassettes and CD recordable media. So they have attacked that particular problem.
But as far as legal enforcement, though,
backwards. Instead of going through it at the tipping point where they actually do the copying, they've gone and done it in the back end, which forces the prices up.
Which is it's probably a much smarter way. I mean, that actually addresses the problem a lot smarter way than what the plaintiffs did here. But to me, it's convenience. I mean, it's you have a certain amount of file copying that will occur, you know, or song copying is going to occur under old-fashioned means of reproduction. You have a heck of a lot more that's going to occur when all you got to do is log on, you know, type a couple of keystrokes, and boom, you're downloading the songs. You know, you didn't have 50 million people that had become obsessed with copying their neighbor's CDs, you know, like you did at its heyday when Napster had 50 million users, you know, who would jot song titles down during the day so they could rush home and download them. Question?
Two things, actually. First thing, you can't really say that they can't crack down on copyright violation when it becomes mainstream because they didn't do it when it wasn't mainstream. That's not reasonable.
I agree.
You can't make something illegal because people will do it anyway. That's a nonsensical argument. My question I actually wanted to ask is, does recording things off the radio count as reproduction legally?
That's a good question. I mean,
you can tape things off cable on your VCR and you have your movie collection.
Yeah, I guess the argument would be whether it's time shifting or not, which is the reason it's legal in the U.S. to, you know, copy an episode of, you know, whatever your favorite, The Simpsons, and have that VCR in your house is the justification the court used back in the Sony case, however many years ago that was that it was time shifting. They said, you're not really making an unlicensed copy. You're not ripping off the owner of the rights to the TV show. All you're doing is shifting the time that you're listening to it. So I guess the analogy to tape a song off the radio and listen to it later would be the same. Yeah, exactly. TiVo adheres to the time-shifting model even better than traditional tapes do. There's no technological fix for anything, whether we're talking about this, spamming, fraud. I mean, that's one of the absolutes, I think, is that there is no absolute technological fix simply because it's always going to be a game of one-upsmanship.
I want to give an interesting example that I've experienced overseas. In the United Kingdom, they have digital broadcasting FM, which is basically pure digital stream being downloaded to your radio. You can pull it off directly, pure digital, onto your computer and then record the song. Technically, this is legal because it's considered time shifting. The United Kingdom has a process of allowing time shifting. And also, because the copyright fee has already been paid by the radio, for your own personal listening, this is available. The question then comes to, why does the United States believe that it has the right to control what the rest of the world views as legal? That's also what this case also brought up, is this Napster product wasn't just used in the United States. This product was used in other countries where this is actually still legal. Why does the United States feel that it has the right to overrule the rest of the world?
Well, they don't. As a matter of fact, we'll talk in just a second about the fact that one of the elements the court has to look at in deciding what to do with Napster is whether Napster software has any legitimate uses. And that's one of the things that the Ninth Circuit found that the trial court was wrong about. The trial court said, only this illegal use here. And the Court of Appeals said that's ridiculous. You know, that there are a number of legitimate uses for Napster, which would ostensibly include file swapping of songs in foreign countries where that's permitted. But just so y'all don't think that the U.S. is too horrible, either last week or week before last, within the last couple of weeks, a couple of brothers who wrote and administer the Korean version of Napster were arrested and faced criminal charges and up to like 5 or 10 years in jail for the same type of violations, exact same type of claims criminally that have been asserted civilly here in the Napster case in the U.S. All right, moving on. I told you we're talking about the fair use defense. That was Napster's question here.
What are they going to be doing about the other forms of file sharing? Are you involved in that at all? Because, there's Audio Galaxy, Kazaa, all sorts of things that are not only now violent into music, but they're treading into movies, yeah, software.
Hold that thought for 1 second, because that's the problem now. Napster has unleashed just a horrible force now, because the plaintiffs have, by basically bringing about the demise of Napster. Napster's going to be back with a subscription-based service here soon, and day before yesterday, they fired Hank Barry, their old CEO. They got a new fella in who's from Bertelsmann. He's saying that they'll be back very soon with their subscription-based model. They'll get probably a few million of their 50 million people back who, because you like what you're familiar with, maybe you'll have a little bit better selection. Maybe they'll offer some perks. Who knows what? Some people will be happy to pay their $7.95 or $9.95 or $20 a month or whatever it is for unlimited download. Or I think last I heard they were going to have several models, some per song, some unlimited, different levels of membership. But what you have right now is, in this interim, when the plaintiffs shut Napster down, as opposed to trying to effect a transition with some continuity of membership of Napster, what they've done is forced all the 50 million people that were using Napster to go to all these other services. And the problem is, these other services, unlike Napster, don't use a central server architecture. With Napster, there are all the users out here who are the ones doing the bad thing, But there's Napster, who's enabling it, who keeps the master list of all the songs on its server, which is necessary for the Napster model to work. Now you've got Nutella and about 8 or 9 other models, all of which are competing to become the next Napster, which have a decentralized architecture, which means that there is no central server. The users download software, and then it's like, it's like if your buddy, it's a network composed solely, a peer-to-peer sharing, a network composed solely of whoever happens to be online at that time. If everybody logs off, there's no such thing as Nutella. Yeah.
I'm one of these poor people who've been dealing with the internet for over 10 years. And one of the joys that I heard when I first joined the internet was the internet considers our restriction of speech just to be another blockage, and we'll always just route around it. That's something that this court case has proved to me significantly, that as soon as you try and block off something off the internet, it will sprout up at least 5 to 10 more exact versions of what you're trying to stop. And that's something that this court, the ARIA, whatever they're called, It's worthless. You've beaten the dead horse. It's now sprouted up 5 exact basic copies of what you're doing, and they're better than what Napster have actually done because there's no centralized model. You can't choke them off like you could with Napster.
Well, exactly, and that's... What you just described is symptomatic of the problem that we have, you know, from big business point of view, from a purely mercenary money point of view, from big business point of view, from the court's point of view with some of these judges, you have people making business decisions about the internet. You have judges making law about the internet that don't understand the internet. I mean, it's still relatively new as in the grand scheme of society. And so you've got the 65-year-old CEO of a blue-chip company.
Hey, I work for one of those blue-chip companies. I'm actually one of the CEOs for a huge hedge fund. And I've come from both ends. I used to play basically with Win Linux when it first came out, and also I've had to deal with the CEO who basically says to me, well, why the hell can't we just stop these people downloading it? I says, well, if we stop them just downloading it, then they'll just get it somewhere else. Well, why? And it takes years to try and explain to the... I would gather what I call is the older style of business, the pointy head boss, as Scott Adams would probably more colloquially say, that the internet changed the way law and business had to be conducted, and the whole world is running significantly behind the technology, which is actually it's actually very rare that we find that technology has overtaken business and law at the same time, and we're actually in a very interesting void for about probably the next 5 years whilst it catches up.
Well, I'm not sure even in 5 years it'll catch up because our whole system of business and especially the laws that govern business are based on a theory of geographical borders. And now there are no geographical borders. You bring up a great point. Let's take this exact same Napster case. But say that Napster was an Argentinian company with all of its servers in Argentina. Or you've got the... Who's the guy that has the self-declared company, country, Sealand?
Sealand.
Yeah, Sealand. Suppose these are Sealand servers.
There's absolutely nothing anybody can do.
Any person
except Memphis, Tennessee. They're all subject to Memphis, Tennessee.
No, that's Californian law. The whole world is subject to Californian law. We found that out.
Yeah.
There are no borders.
Although I bet Sealand's defenses wouldn't last too long with an airstrike. But,
Well, actually, surprisingly, they would. Because if you actually look at the Sealand, which is about, I think it was about 15 miles off the United Kingdom's coast, mm-hmm. It's actually, the French government has actually declared that it will defend Sealand.
Like I said, the airstrike.
and you ask yourself why bother, but there's not a very big place, I doubt many people would actually hit it from
yeah. But just as an example, suppose that Napster's not subject to U.S. jurisdiction. You get into all kinds of jurisdictional anomalies. Pornography is to be judged upon the standards of the community in which it's being distributed and in which the charges are being brought, okay? Suppose you've got a San Francisco porno company, or your servers in San Francisco, all that, and somebody, you know, I don't know why they'd have a computer, but let's say somebody in an Amish community in Pennsylvania accesses your site, and because your site is available there, you're brought up on obscenity charges in Pennsylvania.
Years.
Yeah. Or the, you know, for another one, gambling. Suppose you go to Antigua, where gambling is offshore gambling, internet gambling is legal. You set up your internet gambling company. You target U.S. citizens, and then you come back to the United States to defend the criminal charges against you by arguing that you set up a legitimate foreign company that is doing things legally under that foreign country's laws, and that you're not subject, therefore, to the laws of the states, and they find you guilty and put you in jail. Which is exactly what happened to the owners of one of the offshore gambling sites, which most of the Americans that own those sites are expatriates for the most part. They leave and don't come back. But one of them came back because he wanted to prove his legal point, and he ended up getting put in jail. Question back there.
There have been a couple of instances where people have actively tried to take services offshore, like the anonymous remailers, where foreign governments have been pressured to act against these people at the behest of the United States. And that also happened with the Norwegian government, with the kid that was arrested for the... I mean, so what's your opinion of stuff like this when you try and take it overseas, and even when you try and do that and stay away from United States jurisdiction, and they get your foreign government to come after you on their behalf?
Well, I think that there's no absolutes. One point there is you choose your country, because some countries have actually set themselves up as a haven, you know, either impliedly or expressly saying, you know, we're not going to give in to the U.S. We're not going to help them out one bit. You'll be safe here. But let's take an extreme example on one end. Suppose that you know, some country that we've never heard of says child porn is absolutely legal, come here and do what you want to, and we have all the U.S. kiddie pornographers that go there and broadcast out, you know, their pornography, just flood the U.S. market with it. Is that something where that government should be held accountable at some point to some world organization?
I'd like to bring up an interesting point that was expressed to me in a legal, as you might know, I actually did some legal studies for a while. As you might have figured out, I did a whole bunch of legal studies. And one of the legal studies that I actually did was about 6 years ago on internet connectivity. And we did a very interesting article about how the U.S., the internet, about 6 years ago, was completely U.S.-centric. You never connected from one country to another country. No pictures, please. And you always had to go via the United States. Every single packet had to come via the United States. And that is how the United States originally decreed that any packet that was traversing across its network was considered to be coming under the jurisdiction of U.S. law. Now, a lot of countries had a real big problem with this, because the U.S. law, whilst is a reasonable law, and you have some pretty good laws, you also have some pretty strange laws that other countries find very difficult to deal with. So a lot of the countries started developing interlinks between the countries, and this happened 5.5 years ago. The U.S. still hasn't figured out that most of the traffic actually doesn't route through it anymore. It's now only about 80% of the traffic goes ex-U.S., i.e. never touches the United States. But the laws that are continuing to be pushed, such as Napster not being allowed to be used internationally, is considered that all the packets are going through the United States, and it's not. And that is why you're able to get the worldwide hit on Napster and not be able to violate other countries' laws, is because of this AT&T proposal that they just signed up with the Department of Justice 6.5 years ago, that any packet that comes into the United States is considered to be able to be followed U.S. law.
Yeah, well, and I guess a couple of points that I'll bring up. One, it would be a different case. Suppose Napster's in the U.S., and they are only dealing in, Australian songs, and say I'm just pulling the country around. Say there's some law that says that it's fine to swap out these Australian songs. There'd be no violation there. I mean, it was the U.S. violation by Napster on U.S. soil, the combination of those two things that gave jurisdiction. But you know, the U.S. is not the only bad guy here. I mean, going back to picking on France, Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, y'all all heard about the Yahoo case in France.
Can I raise a small matter of practical importance here?
Yeah, in 1 minute or less, in France, it is illegal to trade in Nazi memorabilia, of any kind. And I guess the right. Okay. Yeah. World War II, pre-World War II, and World War II, Nazi stuff you can't trade in. And long story short, the French government pursued Yahoo because of Yahoo's eBay-type auctions, at which, U.S.-based Yahoo now. And very interesting is that although Yahoo has a French affiliate, that played no role whatever in this case. The jurisdiction wasn't based on the French affiliate. It was solely based on Yahoo being a U.S. company, which made auction sites available via the Internet to people in France. People in France would log on to Yahoo USA, bid on a Nazi helmet or whatever, buy it, and the French government alleged that put Yahoo in violation of this French law. France came after Georgia Tech a few years ago because there's a law there that says that if you have branches or related companies or whatnot on French soil, then you have to have your website in French as well. And because Tech had some branch over in France, they said, Georgia Tech, you're in violation because your U.S. Georgia Tech website is not in French as well. So that, there are worldwide jurisdictional questions. It's not just the U.S. trying to, bully, as is sometimes the case, but it's not here. Question back there.
I believe we're talking about eminent domain there. Is that the correct name for the principle?
It's really more of a jurisdiction and jurisprudence than an eminent domain type issue, I think.
As a matter of technical validity, I mean, the bumper sticker is that everybody believes says, the net treats censorship as damage and routes around it. But as a matter of practical implementation these days, that's not necessarily true. I mean, there are several examples around the world. Singapore is probably the best known one. But the fact that it is possible to route and prevent your citizens from getting unfettered net access. And the difference is that an extreme case, like you said, if some country suddenly said child porn is legal, will be a haven for the servers, it would be very possible to cut off those servers simply by making it illegal and punishable by horrendous fines and imprisonment or whatever for anybody to establish a data link to that country.
Right, but
territory. We already do that with countries like Libya and Iraq and so forth.
In which case, so you are indirectly prohibiting them by governing the actions of people within your borders. They're over here doing their thing, and you say if you're in our country, you can't do it. Which becomes a very, very difficult, as a practical matter, enforcement.
Oh, the enforcement wouldn't be perfect, but it would probably be better than 90% effective, particularly if we're talking about implementing it in this country.
Exactly. Exactly. Another question here.
I was just going to ask to go back to the slides here.
Okay.
Since we seem to have gotten on topic, but off of the...
But it's also a very interesting conversation, I'll say.
True.
All right, back to the slides here, and I'll try to get through these kind of quickly. I said we talk about the fair use defense. Napster said, well, there's really three separate reasons that what we're doing is okay. First off, we're only sampling. All these users out here are only making a temporary copy of the song before they go out and buy it. That's number one. Number two is space shifting. All they're doing is accessing songs they already own on the CD, which is what you were talking about a little while ago. Third argument is permissive distribution. Hey, a lot of these songs that are being swapped are from artists who've given their permission. Plaintiffs, you don't even have the right to tell us not to do anything, not to allow these songs to be swapped. What is the fair use defense? It's statutory. That means it's passed by an act of Congress. It's a law. To determine if something is a fair use, you look at the purpose and the character of the use, the nature of the copyrighted work, how much of that work is used, and the effect of that use upon the cash value, the market value of the work. The court, and this is all from the Ninth Circuit's opinion, the court looked at the purpose and the character of the use. here they said, does it simply replace the work, or does it somehow improve on it? Is it additional artistic interpretation or impression? Are they doing some mix with all these songs or whatnot, or is it just recording the song? And what the court here said that this is just a mere retransmission of the exact same song. That's almost never a fair use. What's more, this new work, the copy, is purely commercial as opposed to being non-commercial, as would be the library use that we talked about. Number one, because the requester is anonymous. It's not the case of your next-door neighbor. There's no relationship. It's just somebody else who sees a song online and wants to download it. And secondly, because the downloading person would otherwise have to buy it. Second fair use element is the nature of the work and the use. That's the easy one. Musical compositions are by definition creative, and creative works get the most protection. Next is the portion used. Court said this is wholesale copying. You know, we're not talking about a 5-second sample, you know, like the It's a Hard Knock Life rap song where they use the 5 seconds of the, you know, song from Annie, but it's really the rap song. It's not that. We're just copying the whole song. Last is the effect of use on the market. And we still have people debating. A lot of people are saying that the slump in record sales that we've seen from February this year through August this year is attributable to Napster being down. The Napster experts gave compelling evidence that it really was biting into record sales. I mean, my common sense tells me that it has to bite into record sales, because if you want a song and you can get it free, you're not going to go buy the CD. But you know, if you want it bad enough, you'll go buy the CD. So. This was a part of it that was a battle of the experts. And courts almost never disparage experts, but they actually threw a sentence in, the Ninth Circuit did, that said that the Napster experts' reports were dubious at best. Then the court, after going over these four general elements for fair use, the court went back and looked at the three specific claims by Napster. Yeah.
Since Napster had been in use, that the record sales had actually increased.
The court talks about that, and what the court said was that proves nothing, because if the record sales while Napster was in use had been at a gradual, you know, going up, but at this rate, they may have otherwise gone up at that rate, which is what the plaintiff's experts testified to. I mean, and it makes sense. Just because it went up, you can't say that there may be a correlation, but there's no cause effect.
Most people actually do want to support an artist whose music they enjoy.
Well, then let them buy the CD. Or let them pay a subscription rate and not use the decentralized services that allow them to steal the songs. I mean, go ahead and boo for that comment. That's how
boo.
I feel. One more comment.
If you're trying to say people are not pirating things and that they're not saving money that they would have spent, I'm sorry, you can't really say that. It's immaterial. If they're losing any money, then they are losing money that they're entitled to because they own those copyrights. If they're losing any money. That's a totally different issue from legality.
The person's not bad, he's just doing a bad thing, right?
I mean, if one person didn't buy a CD...
CDs. But, you know, it compensates, and the rest of the stuff that I didn't like, I pretty much threw away because I didn't want to keep it.
Which you were one of the rare users who was truly using it for sampling as opposed to replacement of purchased license.
How do we know that that's rare? Okay, in other words, did anybody actually go out and do a survey? Did anybody actually go and statistically prove that it's rare?
Yeah, I got to agree here that it doesn't turn on a majority of the use necessarily, but it's a fact that it's at the very least a substantial number of Napster users were using it for that. And again, a lot of that was the battle of the experts. If we had access to the court files, we could bring in probably reams of pages where they had statistical survey studies, had hired pollsters, had done this, that, and the other, had mathematically figured it out. And
exactly.
Did they correlate the study with the economy at all? The record sales study, did they correlate that with the economy at all?
I'm sure both sides correlated it in whatever way was most beneficial for the opinion they wanted the court to reach.
And the opinion you have about Napster users, I myself own hundreds of CDs. The music I download off of Napster is because I would like MP3s on my computer to listen to, and it's easier to download them than to encode them myself from the hundreds of CDs that I already own. Also, there's stuff that you can download, samples that people make, that you can't get on the CD, you can't purchase anywhere.
And let me clarify, I am not condemning Napster users. If it's used for sampling, if it's used to download material with the permission of whoever owns the rights in that, whether or not it's a technical violation if you do it because you already own the CD, those are not the uses of Napster that I have a problem with. I do have a problem with people that download songs in lieu of buying the CD.
But you're assuming all users are like that, and that's incorrect.
No, I'm not assuming.
You say the majority is, and that's incorrect.
I think a majority. I think statistically a majority of the use is infringing a Napster. I mean, I think that, and I'm sure they had debating experts on that, and that's just my opinion. That's the court's opinion, too, based on the expert testimony and reports that it read. But, I mean, if I had to bet, I would bet, too, that most of Napster downloads are infringing as opposed to the pure sampling or pure replacement of the CDs. We were talking about the sampling here just for a second. Sampling, number one, it is commercial because the download is full, free, and permanent. I mean, if it's pure sampling, Napster could have theoretically figured some kind of technology where there was a timeout, where you download it and the file becomes unreadable or is deleted or whatnot after 24 hours. You know, but that wasn't the case. It was permanent. Question here.
Yeah, what's the legal difference between a public library where I could borrow a CD in Palo Alto and tape a Bartok piece compared to Napster? What's the legal difference?
Commercial versus non-commercial. Fair use versus not fair use. Academic versus non-academic.
I pay a lot of taxes into the Palo Alto Public Library, and my behavior is not any different. The library's behavior is different?
No, the library is an academic, non-commercial, governmental, fair use entity.
They're noble and lofty, and if Napster were put on by Georgia Tech, it would be noble and lofty too?
No.
You don't know Georgia Tech's
Yeah, I went to Tech, so just... And going back to your question again about sampling, the court said that it does harm the CD market. And they said even if CD sales did increase, they could have increased more, so that's not necessarily a cause-effect relationship that you can draw. Space shifting, the court here said that the argument about, well, I already own the CD, so I'm copying it over. You know, it's easier to do it that way. All I'm doing is making another copy of something that I already have. The court said that's not the case here. We're not going to apply the Sony, you know, time and space shifting argument or the Diamond case where the court said the use of the Rio MP3 is fair because the shifting here was distribution to the general public. And the court said that under these particular circumstances, it wouldn't be a fair use even if the downloader did own the CD. I'm not sure I agree with that. The court, I think, may have overstepped there. But the fact of the matter is, again, I'm sure they have reports on this and whatnot, but... I would bet that a very, very small percentage of the total downloads on Napster was for songs in relation to which the person already owned the CD. Permissive reproduction goes back to somebody's comment about what percentage of the song, the downloads that the plaintiffs claim were violative. The plaintiffs here said, and the court said too, you know, this is not even an issue. The plaintiffs never complained about the other 20% of Napster downloads that were songs that did not fall in the realm of those owned by the plaintiffs. Yeah, question here, then go there.
I'd like to go back to the commercial issue. In what way does permanence yield this a commercial activity?
Repeat a little bit louder.
In what way does the fact that the downloads are permanent yield this to be a commercial activity? I don't understand that part of the conclusion.
Okay. because this was made in relation to the sampling argument. If you have a song you can only listen to, let's say you're claiming that it's not a commercial, it's not in lieu of going out and buying, it's not having a commercial effect, it truly is to help you decide whether or not you want to buy it. Well, it would support the argument there if it was only a 10-second snippet. Like if you go to cdnow.com, you can listen to a 8-second, 10-second, whatever it is, snippet of the song. That's not a complete download. I mean, that's not a complete version of the song. It's also not permanent. There are some timeout downloads that you can get, partial downloads, where you download the song, you can listen to it, but you're unable to access the file after 24 hours.
But that doesn't establish any form of commercial impact.
But it's permanent.
It doesn't matter if it's permanent. It doesn't establish...
MP3 files on your hard drive are not permanent.
It doesn't establish any form of commercial impact unless you can demonstrate that someone who acquired that song would have, in fact, paid for it. If everyone in the world that doesn't like ABBA downloads ABBA songs, they were never going to go and buy those. So it has no ultimate commercial impact upon the companies. You have to demonstrate a causal relationship between an action and a commercial reaction to this. And I don't see any causal relationships being demonstrated. I hear, oh, well, the overwhelming majority of use, but at the same time, well, yes, CD sales did go up, but that's not necessarily related. You know, well, don't look at the actual numbers. I'm not understanding the commercial side of this argument.
Some of it has to be inferences drawn from statistics and drawn from math and drawn from the experts. But I mean, the bottom line
specifically go against that part of the argument. They say no, it's bullshit.
I mean, the bottom line is if there are 50 million people downloading however many 100 million songs, as a matter of common sense, every person downloading the song is not going to have not bought the song otherwise. I mean, there's necessarily going to be a substantial number of those people who download the song and then don't buy it because they've got the version for free.
Can you demonstrate that?
Well, the experts did to the satisfaction of the court, and I think common sense would have to tell you that's the truth, too.
Common sense rarely applies to macroeconomics.
Different topic for a different seminar, economics and common sense. Question here? One more, then we'll move on. All right.
Just relating to the point that you were talking about, it basically is the right of the copyright holder or the songwriter or the artist or whoever to determine how their work is exploited. And, you know, they can determine whether or not, hey, this is okay, this is cool that we go ahead and we allow people to go ahead and download something. Or they can determine, no, you need to go and you need to go buy a CD in order to get a licensed copy.
Commercial impact been demonstrated, and it, as near as I can tell, it has not.
Well,
that's a specific point of law.
To actually address that, we would have to have the thousands of pages of the expert reports and the numbers and all, which you don't have access to. The court just says we look at them all and we believe the plaintiff's experts. And as I said, not having read the reports and seen the graphs and heard the expert testimony and all, I got to believe that the court reached the right decision that people getting millions of songs for free over the internet is going to have a detrimental effect on them going out and buying the same songs. I mean, that's the way music works. You hear a song you like, you have a band you like, they put out a new CD, you want to get that CD, you go buy it.
Let's be realistic here. CD sales have gone up because of Napster and other peer-to-peer distribution models. The real issue here is labels don't want to lose their monopoly on their distribution model. They're terrified of the artists being able to sell directly to their fans. And them getting cut out. That's what has them the most scared. And a lot of artists are realizing they don't need the labels.
You're right. And that exact point is why this whole case was so absolutely positively stupid by the plaintiffs. I mean, it's funny. If I'm an artist, I've got to be loving this whole case. Because what they've done is, you know, it's like, what was the creature mythology where you cut off one head and...
The Hydra.
Yeah, the Hydra. I mean, they've cut off one head of the Hydra and... I was going to say 1,000, about a dozen or so much, much worse heads have grown back like that.
Napster was a beta. There are a lot better things out there now.
Exactly.
And the artists are taking advantage of it. The fans are taking advantage of it. And Napigator, for those of you who don't know about it, a good Napster replacement is basically an add-on for Napster that lets you go out and look
at OpenNAP servers. A lot of them located outside the U.S., so you can still use your Napster program to choose which servers you connect to. Copyright laws in the U.S. don't necessarily apply outside the U.S., too. So places in Italy where it's perfectly legal to trade what we would call bootlegs here, available all over the Internet outside the U.S. I was late. Sorry.
That's all right. No, it's a good jurisdictional point you make, though. Yeah. Question over here.
Yeah. As with the statistics, when anyone talks about statistics, if you're good with math, you can make them prove whatever you want. I mean, there's a – keep forgetting, but there's a book from the 1950s.
About how to Lie with Statistics, yeah. And the saying is lies, damn lies, and statistics. Yeah, I have a copy of How to Lie with Statistics in my office right now as we speak. So, again, a good point you make. All right, jumping back here, court shot down the fair use defense. Next question becomes is – that shows that Napster's users are infringing. So the question becomes, if the users are infringing, is Napster helping them? Is Napster guilty of contributory copyright infringement or vicarious copyright infringement? Contributory requires that Napster knew or should have known that its users were infringing, and they materially contributed. And we're getting a little toward the end of the session. I want to have time to field some more questions. The court said that, yeah, both those things are true here. Napster, that the users were infringing, and Napster was materially assisting them. And the court focused on the point that Napster could have taken steps to prevent the user's infringement and didn't, which gets us into some of the things that have happened since this decision came out in February. The court said the plaintiffs are going to win on their contributory claim. Vicarious is sort of the same type analysis. Requires Napster to have a direct financial interest in its users' infringement, and requires that Napster have the right and ability to supervise the infringing activity, which Napster has both here. They could have stopped it and didn't, and Napster's entire financial model was built on increasing its number of users. There were some other defenses that Napster started throwing out. It's kind of like they lost and they were throwing everything in the kitchen sink out, and the court dealt with these in one paragraph saying, you know, that's ridiculous, that's ridiculous, that's ridiculous. Waiver, implied license, et cetera. Oh, that's an interesting one. One argument that Napster said is that they had an implied license that even though the plaintiffs said no, 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 they meant yes, yes, yes. Because they supported MP3 exchange. The original injunction, the court had said that Napster was liable for any infringement that went on using his system, absolutely liable. The Court of Appeals narrowed the scope of that injunction. Napster also tried to say, well, instead of shutting us down, just make us pay a royalty. And the court said, no, we're not going to make the plaintiffs go into business with you. Napster said a $5 million bond is too small. If you get an injunction against somebody, you know, if we're in a lawsuit and the court told y'all you had to stop doing something until the end of the lawsuit, this was all a preliminary injunction, which means this injunction is what's in place until the case ends, which is usually 4 or 5 years later or whatnot. So, in effect, the preliminary injunction is often the most important part of the case. But to protect a party from being just killed with a preliminary injunction placed against it when, at the end of the day, several years later, it turns out they should have won on that. The court was wrong in giving the injunction. They end up winning the whole case. The party that gets the injunction has to place a bond, which, you know, I buy it from a bonding company, put up cash or whatnot, and if it turns out the injunction was wrong, the other party gets that. Napster complained that that a $5 million bond was too small. They wanted some huge amount up in the billions, and court said no to that, too. So back in February, the court affirmed in part and reversed in part the district court's finding. They adopted a lot of the district court's opinion. One thing they did find that we had to speed through because we'd had so much discussion before was that the court said there are other non-infringing legal uses for Napster, so the court wasn't prepared to say that the entire Napster model was illegal, which was just one of the dumb things the district court did. In February, Napster offered $1 billion plus a pardoning, and you know, there's the plaintiff's response: no way. in March, when the court modified its injunction to comply with the scope that the Court of Appeals had directed in its February decision, the court said, okay, there are roughly 135,000 song titles at issue here. You got 72 hours to take reasonable measures to remove these from access to your users for upload and download. After that, downloads dropped by 60%. Aftermath of that, you had the whole coding fiasco, which is what anybody with any sense knew was going to happen. Fade to Black was put in instead of Fade to Black. Eminem, one of the favorite coding methods was it was a text-based blocking system that was put in initially. So you take the last letter of the word, move it to the first letter, and that way all the text filters miss it, so you can continue your infringing downloads. There were several different codes out there, several different translators. In May, the court says, okay, the text isn't working. Even though it's a fairly new technology, never been implemented on a mass scale before, Napster, you use audio fingerprinting. That's the computer there saying, I can name and block that tune in 5 notes. So that's what's going on as we speak. The court, there was another court order in July that said, on top of that, this is the district court, which is really has it in for Napster, it seems like. Court said, just so you know, Napster, we're adopting a zero tolerance level. If you allow one infringing song to slip through, you're in violation of our order, horrible things are going to happen, etc. A month ago, the Ninth Circuit issued another order and said, no, that's not how it's going to be. Aftermath, this was kind of interesting. One of Ames' arguments that was, it was so stupid and so funny that I liked it. I mean, it was a novel approach. The DMCA prevents reverse engineering of encryption algorithms. So I can't, if there's something encrypted, I can't sit down and try to crack it. Amster was using some kind of pig Latin, put the last letter to the first letter, which we can look at it with a naked eye and read it. You can write 3 lines of code that'll convert that back to English so the text filter catches it. Amster argued that those 3 lines of code violated the DMCA because they represented an illegal cracking of their encryption algorithm, which was kind of funny.
For explaining that to us, couldn't the FBI arrest you right now like they did
to Dimitri? Yeah, but very possibly so. Although, I hate to say this with their quarter on, I'll be nice, as thinly stretched as their resources are, and given the apparent inability of them to pitch in and help on other criminal matters to which I have alerted them on behalf of my clients, I sit secure here knowing that I'm not fixed to be swarmed in by a task force. But anyway, Napster told Amster, please remove your pig Latin encoder. And so I had a deference to Napster, and so they went and ended up in a lawsuit with Napster. Amster took that off. Now they're a bunch of I call them Napster wannabes, but they're actually better than Napster. Nutella, MusicCity.com, Morpheus, Audio Galaxy. Does anybody know how to pronounce Kazaa? K-A-Z-A-A with the K, the Z, and the last A all capitalized. Kazaa, iMesh, all these different ones. And as we talked about, these are decentralized. There are no central servers. There's no Napster, so to speak, to go after. If all the users log off, there is no such thing as Nutella at that moment in time. It's purely peer-to-peer, decentralized file sharing. And so that's going to be an entirely different animal for the plaintiffs to go after. The only way you could possibly go after that would be to attack the end users. And that's, number one, impractical. And number two, it would just be horrendous for public relations. Kind of the same type. Do what? Well, I bet you nobody will be too quick to follow Metallica's steps. They're probably the most hated band in the world right now.
An interesting idea for one of the peer-to-peer music distribution systems. How much do you think Metallica would have bitched if for every MP3 of theirs that was exchanged, they got a 1 penny micropayment sent to a PayPal account exclusively for them? not their labels to access, just the band members.
None at all, which is gets back to why it's such a horrible idea, the way that the plaintiffs panel this case. I don't think people would have raised that much cane if there had been a transition without putting Napster down, without shutting down, without all this legality, if there had been a negotiated subscription-based service. I mean, in theory, there's no problem with a subscription-based service, and I think a lot of people who were already on Napster and using it and had the software would have had no problem for the convenience of continued use because they're familiar with it, because of the increased service and songs they would have gotten. Fine, they'll pay some amount per month that would have been fair to everyone. But by shutting Napster down and chasing people away to these decentralized ones, they've made it impossible now to, I think impossible to ever implement an effective subscription-based service because of the decentralized nature of the transactions now.
This is why I was thinking of something that would completely bypass labels entirely and kind of say to the artist, hey, look, here's how much money you can get without having to go through the labels. Every time one of your MP3s is exchanged, you get money. The label doesn't. Labels freak. Artists go, be very interesting. All you coders get busy out there.
And I don't know. I depending on what kind of mood I'm in, I'll argue that that's where we're going toward things. You know, and ideally that would be. But you know, other times, you know, if I'm in a cynical mood, the truth of the matter is that if you don't get, you know, in the MTV rotation and you don't get on the right radio stations in the big cities, nobody ever hears you. It's kind of the whole theory with American pop culture. What's popular is not necessarily what's good. It's what gets crammed down our throat.
I'm a national DJ and I've worked music for over a year.
Yeah. All right, so winner is, who do you think is the big winner in all this? I hadn't heard the right answer yet. No, still hadn't heard the right answer. The lawyers. Nobody. Nobody, that's right.
The lawyers.
All right, any more questions, comments, whatnot? Up here in front? You're closer back there, so. Okay, two questions, and then they're pulling the plug on me.
Would you care to address the technological limitations of decentralized servers?
I could. My undergrad degree is computer science from Tech. I consider myself as technologically savvy as any attorney out there. But as soon as I started talking about the limitations and the specifications, the technology end of the decentralized server model, probably three-fourths of y'all know more about that than me. So I'll pass there. But any comment, real quick, any comments on that, though? Is there any way to shut down decentralized?
Not really.
I don't think so. Well, but there's so many ISPs and so many ways to get around backbone imposed restrictions. Question.
My question is that I know not for the past, but later, you know, in the future, they're planning on making those new stealth disks, where that if you try to download off the system, that there's going to be too much distortion to make an MP3.
That, again, it goes back to what I said. The one absolute I'll say is that a technological fix ain't going to work because it's always a game of one-upsmanship. It's just who's winning. Who came out with the neater, niftier trick or code that particular week? But there'll always be give and take back and forth in that. All right, we're getting – that's it. I think plug's being pulled, getting run out here. I'll be happy to talk with any of y'all outside afterwards. Really enjoyed it. Thank y'all for the comments and the argument and the back and forth. I appreciate it.